Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, Zoe. She's a 20-something woman living in New York City with crushing student loans and credit card debt. Although Zoe is a fictional character, her story is very real. You probably know people who are living in these circumstances, if not in New York City. David Bach will be here to take us through his latest book, The Latte Factor, and how, just like Zoe, he believes you too can live a richer life by making small changes, starting with your $5 latte. And, hey Siri, or okay Google, artificial intelligence is changing how we live in so many ways, big and small, including how we invest. Bristolgate Capital Partners is an investment company that uses AI and machine learning to create a unique set of investment products. Its senior portfolio manager, Izzet Elmazi, is going to be here to talk about how his company uses artificial intelligence. And AI can be used for online banking, too. RBC just launched their Nomi Budgets. It's an online banking tool for all you non-budgeters out there. Senior Vice President of Digital Peter Tilton will be here to tell us how this app uses AI to create a personalized budget for each user and helps them stick to it. Plus, an online tool to help you find a financial advisor. Founder Solomon Amos is going to be here to talk about advisor savvy and how it works. All that is ahead. Let's get started. The latte factor. It's a concept that has been around for years, popularized by personal finance expert David Bach. And it is the title of his latest book. This one is number 13 on a list that includes massive bestsellers like The Automatic Millionaire and Smart Couples Finish Rich. David is a speaker and a commentator who has appeared on The View, The Oprah Winfrey Show, and as a regular contributor on The Today Show on NBC. He joins us now from New York City. Hello there.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me on your show.
The latte factor. What do you have against coffee? Are you trying to put Starbucks out of business? You're not like a tea drinker, are you?
Coffee. In fact, let me tell you, because I've been traveling nonstop, I just have myself a little espresso shot, but I made it at home.
Thank goodness.
The whole idea of the latte factor is that it's always been a metaphor to teach people that you don't need a lot of money to start investing and that small amounts of money can change your whole life. And so we've gone around the, you know, both Canada and the U.S. for nearly 20 years now teaching people, you know, $5 to $10 a day can really change the course of your life if you invest it, if you pay yourself first, if you take advantage of the miracle of compound interest. And it's something that has really shaped the conversation around money really throughout North America. And now with this little book, The Latte Factor, because it's a little story, it's starting to go viral really all over the world now. So super exciting. This book's only been out 2 weeks. We just found out the book is number 2 on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. It hit the Canada's bestseller list, Toronto Star. Love to see that. And it's just rocketing up all the bestseller lists across the U.S. and Canada right now. So
nice.
We're super pumped.
Well, you say, you reference that it is a story. It is. There's a narrative to it. 27-year-old Zoe, this opening scene in the Oculus under the new World Trade Center. Why did you decide to write this book in this way?
Well, I'll tell you why. The reason is there's a major article that just ran in the Wall Street Journal on Sunday that talked about the fact that millennials in the U.S., and I'm sure it's similar in Canada, are further behind financially than any generation ever. And the reason is because they're behind due to student loans, credit card debt. Those two major things are holding back an entire generation, a big generation, a generation of 77 million large that is ultimately going to be bigger than the baby boom generation. And because they're struggling with this debt, they're giving up hope, and they're delaying buying homes, and they're delaying investing, and they're falling behind by decades. And so I decided, you know what, this is going to be my last financial book, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to inspire, educate, and empower the younger generation to realize that they can still have hope. And so I thought, what's the best way I could do this? Well, you know, my life's been shaped by story-based books like The Alchemist from Paulo Coelho, or Who Moved My Cheese was just a fantastic business book. And I wanted for over a decade to write a little story that, you know, anyone could read. My 15-year-old just read this book cover to cover on a plane flight. My 9-year-old has read half the book and is talking about the fact that he doesn't have a latte factor. He has a V-Buck factor. And so I wanted to just really inspire young people. And it's working. You know, most people won't read a financial book. Let's just be totally honest. I've got 7 million books out, and still, most people will never read a financial book. And so I thought, if I can put this into a little story you can read in an hour, I could really start to shape and change the direction of people's lives. And it's happening. Again, this book's only been out for 2 weeks, and on Amazon in the U.S., we have over 200 five-star reviews. That's funny. I was just looking at Amazon Canada, and it's weird that the things don't match up. But the book's just getting, like, this insane positive feedback, and people are buying the book for themselves, reading it, but then they're going back and buying it for graduation gifts.
Tell us about some of the plot points that that Zoe goes through in her life as articulated in the book. What are some things that she deals with and the lessons she learns along the way?
So Zoe's 27 years old, and she lives in Brooklyn, and she works in the Freedom Tower, which I happen to be looking at right now. It's 150 yards from my apartment. And so she commutes from Brooklyn. She takes the subway in the morning, and she's been working at the Freedom Tower for 6 years. And interestingly, she's got this great job. She's working in the travel business. She's a travel editor, but she never gets to travel. And she's been working for 6 years and making more money, but she's not getting ahead. She's still living paycheck to paycheck. So what happens to Zoe is she's coming through the Oculus, which is this incredible underground facility below the Freedom Tower, and she sees this sign on the LCD screen that says, if you don't know where you're going, you might not like where you end up. And it kind of stops her in her tracks. And then she comes up this escalator, and normally she would just come out above ground and rush into her office. But on this day, she stops, and she looks at the 9/11 memorial for the first time in really 6 years, takes it in, and she asks herself a question. Where is she going with her life? And she comes in the office, like a lot of millennials, she's kind of depressed right now. She's been working so hard for 6 years and not getting ahead. And she actually shares that with somebody. She shares it with her boss, a woman named Barbara. And she says to Barbara, you know what, I just don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I can't afford anything. And Barbara starts to send her in the direction of meeting mentors. And these mentors start to teach her that she's richer than she thinks, she's more powerful than she knows, and that her dreams deserve to come true. And they teach her the three lessons to financial freedom that everybody needs to learn.
And those three are?
So lesson number one, what she learns, and it sort of surprises her, is this mentor named Henry, who works at a coffee shop, says to her, you know, you need to learn how to become financially selfish. And she's like, what do you mean? He's like, well, when you go to work at 9 o'clock and you work until 5, the first person who has to get paid is you. He's like, have you heard about this idea of paying yourself first? And she says, well, no, not really. What do you mean? So he walks her through it, and he's like, look, most people go to work, and they work from 9 till about 12 o'clock to pay taxes, and then they spend the rest of the day just paying their bills, and then they're hoping at the end of the day that they'll have some money left over to save. And he says, and that's why most people are broke. Most people work 90,000 hours over their lifetime, and they have nothing to show for it. So he says there's this magic formula that people use with ordinary incomes to become free. It's called saving 1 hour a day of your income, paying yourself first 1 hour a day of your income. And he actually draws it out for her. And she's like, well, how do I do that? So he teaches her, like, you don't actually do what you think you do. You don't use a budget, which is the second secret. You take this money and you automatically have the money moved into a retirement account. And, like, you know, in the U.S. it's a 401k plan. In Canada, it's an RSP plan, right? So he teaches her the power of moving this money automatically. And then the third lesson she learns is that it's not all about putting off money for retirement. It's about actually learning how to live rich now. And he teaches her the power of getting clarity around your values. So he teaches her how to pull out what does her soul really want to do with her life that she's not doing. And in doing that adventure, she writes it all down and she starts to get clarity around what she really wants for her life. and learns how to live a rich life that doesn't have to be put off for someday.
Now, so those are the three secrets, helpful, resonant. There are also some myths of money that you tackle in this narrative. Tell us about those.
Yeah, well, one of the myths is that, you know, somebody else is going to come along and take care of you. And this is a lesson that's taught to her, again, from another woman who says, you know, you can't, I don't care if you marry the local bank president, you can't ever count on somebody else if you're a woman to take care of you. And she goes through some very startling statistics for women. Like she shares, 80% of women die widowed. 80% of men die married. And she starts to say, you know, and most women who end up poverty stricken were not poverty stricken before their husband died. So she says to her, you need to take charge of your financial life now. And then she says, and you know, for men, it's not just for women. Like you can't be dependent on a politician to take care of you. You have to realize that the only one who's going to take care of you is you. And that's kind of an eye-opener for her. The second myth is that if you make more money, you'll be rich. And that's something that people always think, right? If I go make more money, I'll then have the money to save and invest. And she's, you know, then they go through it with her. Well, haven't you been making more money? Like every year you basically begin a little raise, but you haven't been saving anything, right? And she's like, no, because as I make more money, she's been spending a little bit more. And they talk about this thing called lifestyle creep, right? Like as you make more, it's like a boat that goes along with the water. It just rises with the tide. So the idea that you're going to make more money and then invest is like a broken belief. And so she learns to think differently. And then the other thing she learns is that you don't have to have a lot of money to invest. And that's really where the latte factor comes in. You know, he starts to show her this math. And he shows her, you know, $10 a day. And he says, and there's these incredible charts in the book. But he shows her, like, look, $10 a day is $300 a month. And if a person started investing at the age of 25, they could have over $1,913,000 with compound interest at a rate of 10%. And then he shows her, like, that's amazing, right? And she's like, that is amazing. And he goes, well, what if you waited 10 more years? What if you wait till you're 35? And, you know, he shows her, well, that's $684,000. And, you know, so as the decades go on, every decade she waits, she sees that there's this enormous cost to waiting. And that's what's happening, right? Too many people are waiting to start investing because they're waiting to get a pay raise, make more money, have everything be perfect, and know everything there is they need to know. And this book sort of says, you know, you don't need to know everything. You need to save 1 hour a day of your income.
Yeah, get started immediately. I'm speaking to David Bach, the author of The Latte Factor, book number 13 in his, loosely connected series. I do want to ask you about the criticism that some people have of The Latte Factor. And as you talk, it makes me sound like they misunderstand what you're actually saying about The Latte Factor. But the two criticisms that I hear are that it oversimplifies issues that might be very complex. So some people, it's like their big deal is the fact that they spend too much on the Brooklyn apartment, not that they drink too much expensive coffee. It's one. And the second is that, there is a lot of other places where joy is so important. So for some people, the only luxury they have in life is their latte. Don't cut that. Cut something else that doesn't matter so much to their soul, as you put it. What would you say about those two criticisms?
Well, I mean, you just actually nailed it, right? It's actually not about the coffee. And it's kind of funny, right? Because I didn't expect my 9-year-old son to read this book. He only read it because his 15-year-old brother read the book. And he turned to me after reading four chapters or five chapters the next day and turned to me and said, you know, Dad, I don't have a latte factor, but I have a V-Buck factor. So at 9 years old...
Is that a gaming reference?
That's a gaming reference. So at 9 years old, he could already understand it's an analogy. Or a metaphor, and he said, you know, all that money that I wasted on those games, he plays Minecraft, all that money I wasted last year, because I don't even play, he said, I don't even play that game anymore. He's like, if I had that money now, I could invest it like Zoe. And, like, he's 9 and he got it. He took the chart to school and showed his third grade teacher, Patrick, and said, Patrick, look at this little chart. Did you know if you just saved $10 a day, how much money you could have? He's 9. So I think, you know, the reality is you have people who always want to come up with excuses. And the power of the latte factor has always been it actually wakes up people who want to help themselves to go, you know what, I don't know. For some people, look, let's be honest, it is coffee. But for other people, it's just something else. I don't know what it is. It's a metaphor. Mm. I know this. If you're saving 3 or 4% of your income, which is what the average American and Canadian saves, you're not going to have enough money. Right, like I just came from Atlanta where I was doing a CNN show, and the woman doing my makeup was like, well, what's the best mutual fund for me to buy? And I go, let me ask you a question. Are you using your 401k plan at CNN? And she said, well, yeah. And I go, let me guess how much you're saving. She said, well, okay. I go, my guess is you're saving between 3 to 6%. She said, yeah, you're right, I'm saving 6%. I said, it's not enough. You need to be saving 12% of your income. You need to be saving 1 hour a day of your income. And she said, but I'm a stay-at-home mom. I'm a mom with two kids. I'm a single mom with two kids. I can't – there's no way I can go from saving 6 to 12%. And she's got a huge, giant Starbucks cup of coffee sitting on her desk. And I she's like, what's the latte factor about? I'm like, well, there you go. As an example,
right.
If you just cut that out, I go, I'm drinking the free coffee at CNN right now. If you just cut that out – how many of those do you have a day? Well, she has two. Okay, you cut that out – you could take your 401k plan from 6 to 7% or from 6 to 8%. And she's like, would that make a difference? I'm like, it's a life-changing difference.
Yeah. I want to ask you one other question about the book. Chapter 14 goes fast forward 3 years later. Tell us how Zoe's life has changed.
So Zoe, because she's living paycheck to paycheck, once she starts to realize she can have financial freedom, she gets hope back in her life. And so even though it's not like she becomes wealthy overnight, because she starts taking the right actions, she gets hope and she gets courage. Part of the courage that she gets is that she really wants to travel. And instead of saying, asking herself questions like, why can't I do things? She starts to ask herself questions like, how could I do things? That's a really important point in this book. And one thing she wants to do is travel more. So she actually works out a way to take a sabbatical. That is, while she's paid to do it. And she starts to see a whole new way to live her life and also realize that she doesn't have to leave her job to do it. So, you know, I happen to be leaving in 60 days for my own sabbatical. I'm getting ready to move to Florence, Italy. And so as I was writing this book, I was like, you know, I'm going to end my – when this book comes out, I'm going to put this book out, tour across the U.S., and then go take my own sabbatical. And I think that one of the biggest crises we have in – certainly in North America is that people – live to work. They don't work to live. Mm. And, you know, there's really a movement, especially with young people, to want to get free faster and want to have not put their whole life off until the age of 65. Some people call it the FIRE movement. But I just think, you know, learning how to live a rich life before you're 65 right. is critical. And she also learns that lesson from her mother. Like, there's lessons in the book about not being afraid to go for your dreams, which I don't want to give it all away, but that's a very powerful message.
Yeah.
Not having regrets later in life.
Thank you, David. David Bach is the author of The Latte Factor, his 13th personal finance book. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, Bristol Gates' Izzet Elmazi joins us to tell us how artificial intelligence is changing the way we invest. And later, a new way to compare financial advisors and choose the one that's right for you. Saul Amos will be here to talk about advisor savvy and how it works. Now, you don't ever have to miss an episode of Moolala. To listen to past episodes, you can go to our website, moolala.ca, or to any of your podcast providers and download the full podcast from the past and also subscribe for the future. Write us a review, too. That helps other people find us. Wouldn't that be lovely? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Artificial intelligence is constantly evolving and is used in so many different ways. The most common ones for regular people like you and I are probably those like personal assistants like Siri or Alexa or Google Home. But AI can be used for really an infinite number of things, including investing. Bristolgate Capital Partners is an investment company. It uses AI and machine learning to create what it calls a unique set of investment products. Senior Portfolio Manager Izzet Elmazi is here to talk about how his company uses AI. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
So you use AI, data science, machine learning, all those kinds of things. Give us a sense for how it informs the work that you do at your firm.
Well, if you think about what humans are good at and what computers are good at, they're two very different things. Humans are good at coming up with new ideas, thinking outside the box. Computers are good at processing, analytics, taking bias out of decisions. And so we use it to help us find future dividend growers. Essentially, what our machine learning algorithm does is perform a significant amount of calculations over a significant amount of data in a very short period of time and reduces the effects of human bias and the probability of human error within the process.
To feed that AI goat, you need to give it a lot of data. Where does this data come from? Is it regulatory filings?
Absolutely. So we feed it 20 years of historical data on each company in our investable universe. So pretty much every company that's traded in a public market within Canada and the U.S. The data that we source is primarily financial. So it comes from regulatory filings and it comes from data providers or aggregators such as Bloomberg or FactSet. They would be two of our primary data sources, as well as some Fed data.
And what if this is in-house and what if it is outsourced? Like, can you buy this kind of AI stuff off the shelf?
So the algorithm that we use is called a gradient boost machine.
A gradient boost machine.
Correct.
That is full on Back to the Future Part 3. I see Michael J. Fox in the advertisement for that.
It's not that
Is there a DeLorean?
No. But people use this algorithm in various different industries. So the algorithm itself is not proprietary to us. Target or a retailer may use it to forecast the demand for red dresses in size 7 this coming summer season. Another company may use it to predict your use of healthcare or to help in preventative medicine for you as a middle-aged man.
Right. Did you say middle-aged in reference to me?
I was speaking about myself.
And healthcare. Why would I need healthcare? I'm perfectly healthy. Yeah. But I get it. So there's an algorithm that pre-exists and has multiple uses.
Correct. And so what's proprietary to us is the question that we ask. So what problem are we trying to solve? And then what we do with that data. So we get that raw data from those various service providers. How we clean that data, how we manipulate that data, how we structure that data such that it can go into the algorithm to be used to answer the particular question that we're looking to answer. And in our case, that question is, who will be the fastest dividend growers 12 months from now? That is proprietary to us.
And what's the feedback loop? Because one of the amazing things about AI is it learns as it goes. So
Correct.
What would you then be feeding back into that black box that would help it do better?
So why this is a machine learning algorithm is that we do not tell it which features are important in determining what our dividend growth prediction will be for the coming year. So it goes through a series of if-then statements and basically builds these large trees which it then uses to predict dividend growth.
What would be an example of some of the if-thens?
So if revenue growth is greater than 10%, is dividend growth next year going to be 20%?
I see.
And it will go down a series of questions like that. But as you know, if you embed a bunch of if-then statements within if you've ever used Excel and tried to do an embedded if-then statement, that can become pretty complicated pretty quickly as a person.
There is so much talk about AI and how it really permeates every part of our culture. But from your perspective in the investment business, how can you tell if someone's actually using AI or if they've just got these hepped up, steroid-infused Excel models they absolutely crunch lots of data, but they're not learning as they go?
Right. So AI is definitely along the rising tide of the hype cycle. A lot of what's out there right now, I think, is hype. I would look to firms using data and data science or technology for long periods of time. As an example, our firm has been using technology since the very beginning. It's evolved.
Like Alexander Graham Bell beginning? Electricity?
Like 13 years ago beginning. So the initial model that we used was a simple linear regression model. A couple of variables went in it and produced a dividend growth prediction. As technology evolved, we moved to an SAS MATLABs-based model. Those are two packaged analytical software, predictive software applications. Fast forward to 3 or 4 years ago, finally the technology became available to democratize AI and machine learning. Only then did we move to that technology, and we've always run our technologies in parallel such that, A, we can evaluate the new technology. We want to make sure it's working. Mm. And B, that you always want to fail safe just in case something goes wrong.
Is there an opportunity for the override of a human being? And in what circumstances does that make sense?
So, personally, I don't think that there's an opportunity for an override for a human being. At Bristolgate, we very much believe in the man plus machine approach. So,
Person plus machine. Absolutely. You have two exchange-traded funds focused on companies that are growing their dividends, one in the U.S., one in Canada. Why is that your metric of choice?
Because high dividend growth produces great outcomes. At the end of the day, it's going to be hard to earn more than what the business itself earns.
Got it. Dividends, okay? Good.
Dividends matter.
Yes.
Think of us as an apartment building.
Yes.
Okay? We have 22 units for rent in our building. Each year, we try to fill that building up with tenants that can sustain a 20% increase in their rent.
Right.
And if they can't do that, we take them out of our building.
You are mean.
We're mean, but we're a tough landlord.
Did you provide them boxes?
We provide them boxes.
Good.
We'll send them a nice care package and help them move out.
And help them find a new house.
But we have another tenant there who is ready and willing to come in. And our belief is that if our income can grow at high rates every year, the value of our property or our stocks in our case will be much higher 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road than today.
Super fast. How often do you trade? Are you trading all the time?
Our average hold period is over 3 years. So we're very different than a lot of other people using machine learning in their process.
One last question. How does a small firm like you compete with the massive scale of the banks who have entire office towers of servers and the people who can oversee the data?
So it's surprising how few people have made the move to adopt technology and how open-minded or closed-minded they are to adopting new technology. So many of the people at the banks are fundamental portfolio managers and view technology as a risk to their career.
Or a sector to invest in.
Right. Do not view it in all instances as a tool to help them become better investors.
Gotcha.
And so we compete by being open-minded and adopting new technologies as they become available, focusing our efforts on a specific question, which is who will be the fastest dividend growers 12 months from now.
Interesting. Thank you very much for your context. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Izzet Elsmazi is from Bristolgate. We were talking about how to use artificial intelligence in investing. Stay with us. Coming up next, finding a new financial advisor can be really tough. There is another online tool, another as in there's now quite a few of them, that tries to make it easier for you to compare advisors, select a new one. Salman Amos is he's going to be here. He's the founder of Advisor Savvy, and he's going to talk about why he is such a big believer in his model. And later, How I Do It. We'll ask David Bach about how he manages his own money. Can't get enough of Moolala. If you want to join in the conversation, shoot us an email to ask@moolala.ca. That's so old school. You can also connect with us online. Social is at Bruce Selry Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Finding a great financial advisor is a tough task for a whole bunch of reasons. Some people could use a little advice on how to find an advisor, right? There's a new platform called Advisor Savvy, and it claims to be able to help with that. It's an online source that helps you find, compare, and rate local advisors through a collection of reviews and feedback and that kind of stuff. Here to tell us more about the service is its founder, Saul Amos. Hey, Saul.
How are you, Bruce?
I have been talking a lot about these kinds of services in the last couple of weeks and months. I had the founder of Matchworth on a couple of weeks ago. Yep. Why are we hearing about these now? Because these review sites in other parts of the economy have been around for years. You know, rate your professor, rate your contractor. Right. Why are we talking about these now?
We're talking about it now because I think the industry really needs it. When you're a consumer, it's difficult to find that advisor. And when you actually look at it, the facts, there's only about 66% of the people out there, the consumers, that don't have an advisor. And right now you're seeing throughout the industry a transparency that's happening with consumers' investment reports and things like that. So you're starting to see consumers to take a more active role in finding the right advisor.
So how does your model work? There's a bunch of different ones out there. How does your model work?
So my model works is that we bring great advisors to consumers, and consumers have the ability to filter and sort advisors by a whole bunch of different categories, including language, years in business, ratings. So different opportunities for the consumer to find the right advisor based on a whole bunch of different factors that aren't available out there right now.
I talked about the review idea. As your system becomes more entrenched and has more history, will there be a traditional review functionality?
Yep.
Star ratings.
That's correct. And the difference is we're not looking for just one overall rating for the advisor. We actually rate them on five different factors. So we rate them on how often does the consumer feel, is it appropriate that they've received contact from the advisor? Do they have their best interest in mind? Do they feel that the fees are compatible with what they've seen in the marketplace? So we rate based on five different criteria.
When you say we, do you mean the consumer rates?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So if I found my advisor through Advisor Savvy, then I can do a little review like I would do at an Airbnb property.
Yes, you can.
Same thing?
Yep.
Does the advisor review me like on Airbnb or Uber? Or is it a one-way street?
It's a one-way street.
Right. And why did you decide to make that the model?
Well, right now, I think what's needed is there are a lot of great advisors out there, and they don't really have that platform to be able to showcase client reviews, and that's why we've done that. We don't have it right now set up. It's something that we're looking at in the future where the advisor will have the ability to rate the consumer, but right now it's more about the consumer rating the advisor.
Some advisors might get eviscerated in this review process. What is your policy for handling those reviews? I'm sure some of the advisors are like, get that down immediately.
Yep. So there's one key point in ours is that the consumer that comes on needs to sign in to be able to do the rating. And we do this for two reasons. One is to protect the advisor, and one is to protect Advisor Savvy in terms of an audit trail. So if the consumer has a legitimate complaint or legitimate review, we'll follow up with that consumer and ask some more detailed questions on what happened in the instance in the relationship with the advisor.
How do you vet the advisors that you're willing to have on your platform in the first place?
Yeah, so when the advisor signs on board, we actually check if they're in good standing with their regulatory body.
Anything else?
Right now, that's currently what we do.
So they have to be in standing, but they can be jerks, they can be philanderers, they can be terrible with their children, they can have smelly offices. All those things are fine by you.
Well, that's why we have the rating system
right.
and the feedback
That'll
system.
That'll come out in the wash.
That's right.
Tell me how you make your money.
Right. So we have actually three structures for advisors that come on. So they can actually come on free, and then they can come on either two other plans. One is about $21 a month for the advisor. The other one's $35 a month. Now, the reason why, and that works out to about $420 a year, we kept those pricing low for the advisors so that we could have more advisors on the platform. So we're not asking thousands of dollars from the advisor because we knew that would put us in a bad position if there were instances of bad reviews with the advisor.
Right. It's much cheaper than Matchworth or even when MoneySense Approved was in operation. I think that was closer to $2,000.
Yeah. And the reason, again, we do that is we don't want to be put in a in a situation where we can't be unbiased and have feedback from advisors that they're unhappy because they're paying so much. The second point I'll mention is we've kept it at a lower price so that we can bring advisors on that can afford it.
Do I want an advisor who can only afford a $400 ring?
Well, I think in most cases, advisors do a bunch of other things as well. This is just one piece of it.
You're still new. So I was on the platform. I did a search for fee-based advisors, found just one in Calgary. How many advisors do you have now and how many do you need in order to be viable? And I love that we're talking now. You're in the beginning of your life cycle. Yeah. So it's not that I expect you've got what you want to have in 5 years. Right. But how many do you need to feel like, I've got good cross-Canada coverage?
So we're looking to have about 4,000 advisors on the platform in 12 months across Canada. And we do feel that that will provide a good base to cover all of Canada for the needs of the consumer.
13 smart questions everyone should ask their advisors. This is your, like, I don't know if it's your clickbait or your download this right. And we get your email address. Yep. But however you use it for your marketing, I think it's a great question.
Great.
What are some of those 13 smart questions?
Yeah, and you know, the site Advisor Savvy was built really to help the consumer to get confidence in being able to choose the right advisor. So that is just one example of assisting the consumer to ask the right questions when they're getting advice and looking for a financial advisor. But I think some of the more important questions, to your point, Bruce, is really asking about what are their certifications, qualifications to be in that role. The second one I would say is how long have they been in the business? And the third I would ask is, do you have clients that are like me in my situation? And that should give the consumer a good idea of who the advisor is used to working for.
How do you think about fees? This is something I've been talking about for almost a decade. And thing I've said on this show and on many others for that time is, let's remember there's three types of compensation models. There's fee-based, there's fee-only, there's commission-based. How do you include that? Because that is a really relevant part of the decision for a lot of people.
Yes, it definitely is. And when you look at consumers, it's one of the things, especially in the younger consumer category, what they fear the most in terms of looking for advisors, that they can't afford the fee. And so one of the things we have on the site is you're able to sort the advisors by fee only and then no fee or like commission rate. So it's something that we're working on right now in terms of outlining for the consumer.
Do you think people have an adequate understanding of the relationship between fees and performance? Because it's all good. It's all well and good to say, well, the person's in good standing with the regulator. They're a nice person. They smell, you know, they don't have a smelly office or whatever. But if they charge 3.5% in an MER, to me, that just takes them out of the game.
Yeah, I think consumers have an understanding that advisors get paid somehow. It's just they're not sure how they get paid in a lot of circumstances. But that I think in a lot of cases, consumers are warming up to the idea of figuring out what that cost is and how they can use that to find the right advisor for them.
What's a year down the road, 5 years down the road? What are some of the things that you're looking at developing? And I ask because when I had Matchworth on, one of the things that they have is a social component. And it's kind of an interesting thing. Basically, it's like a Q&A. Advisors can weigh in on all sorts of investor questions. But I can imagine that would be a lot of work to build and maintain that kind of a forum.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. We are looking at building a community for the consumer to be able to work with other consumers in their peer network. But Advisor Savvy is set up so that the consumer, that's barrier-free, so the consumer actually doesn't have to sign in to use Advisor Savvy. They can go on and search for the advisors. And I'll only say the good point is that we do have all the social handles for all the advisors on. So if the consumer is not ready to pick the advisor, they can follow the advisor and get a better feel of them.
Do you have an advisor?
Yes, I do.
Do you love your advisor?
I do, and it's one of the reasons I built this site.
Oh, interesting.
I found I was self-advised for most of my life, and then I found a financial planner that actually opened up my eyes to a whole bunch of areas that I wasn't competent in.
Yeah, and the great ones really are great and worth
every
fantastic.
Penny.
Fantastic. Yep. Saul, thanks very much for your time.
I really appreciate it, Bruce.
Saul Amos is the founder of a new platform called Advisor Savvy. He's hoping to help connect investors with great advisors. Stay with us. Coming up next, a personalized budget just for you, or so says RBC. Its Senior Vice President of Digital, Peter Tilton, will be here. He's going to talk about Know Me Budgets and how their new app works. And David Bach is back for How I Do It. We'll ask him how he manages his own money. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Constantly tracking how much money you spend and exactly what you spend and where you spend it is a complete and total chore, especially if you're a stranger to budgeting. But for some people, creating and sticking to a budget can really help them manage their money. RBC has introduced a new app. It's called Know Me Budgets, and it really is focused on the non-budgeters out there. RBC's Senior Vice President of Digital, Peter Tilton, is joining us now. He's going to talk about this new app and how it works. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
There are about, 35,000 financial apps on the iTunes store. Why I'm excited to talk to you about this is I would love for Canada's big banks to develop something that can compete with what they could get externally, because you already have all the data in-house. So I'm hopeful that that the banks can do well by their customers. So tell me what you're trying to do in order to make it easier for RBC customers to budget.
Well, the first thing to add, Bruce, is that this is within the RBC app itself. So it's not a separate app like all those other apps you talk about in the App Store.
Okay.
So that already you have some 4 million Canadians that can instantly benefit from this new Nomi budgeting capabilities. So it's when you think about it, that's a very decent percentage of Canadians, maybe 1 in 7 Canadian adults will benefit from this sort of financial literacy capabilities from the get-go.
And what are you trying to do? What are you doing that isn't already out there and available for people?
Yeah, we believe this one's really unique, actually, and we're quite excited by it. And we're seeing some adoption, which is showing that Canadians are excited by it as well. So the first thing to say is we're making budgeting exceptionally simple. And if you look at other apps, and particularly things which are more about aggregation and classifying transactions, and we have offered those in the past, is they're inherently a fairly sort of cumbersome and time commitment type of process where you'd have to go through and manually classify transactions, figure out your budgets and so forth. The beautiful thing about the Nomi budgeting tool is that it does all the hard work for you. So put simply, what this will do is it just classifies discretionary spend across 5 categories, helps the customer set a budget, and once the budget is set, then Nomi will nudge and remind the customer about how their spend is going throughout the month.
So when you say nudge, if you exceed your budget in a particular area, does your phone emit a piercing scream and then self-destruct?
No. You'll have the option to turn that on later. But
That's in a 3.0. That's the 3.0 version.
But it is really about initially just giving nudges within apps, and then being able to allow customers to receive those sorts of reminders. So it's a simple process of, I'll give you an example. So I might say, hey, Peter, you've spent $1,000 on restaurants last month. That's a lot of money. It's not this language, but it'll give you the feel for it. Spent $1,000 in restaurants last month. That's quite a lot of money. If you look at historically, off all your data, we know that you might have spent $250. Historically, it's a good amount. We might suggest to the customer, hey, Peter, would you like to set a budget of $250? Customer can then toggle that up and down. Once it's set, then Nomi will automatically remind you the 25%, 50%, 75%, 100% mark to try to coach to that set budget. And it sets around 5 different categories.
How does it include numbers from other places? Because one of the challenges has long been is people can't find everything in one place unless they go to one of those aggregators that scrape your data from 12,000 things. If you have a credit card that is from another provider instead of RBC, is there a way to include that spending, or are you out of luck?
No, you can't use another provider's data. And this is the key thing to understand around this sort of data analysis is huge in terms of the amount of quantity of data that we're processing. So what we do tend to find, though, is the vast majority of RBC customers use one of our credit cards and or debit. So we've done the hard work around making sure that it looks across all of those different classification types. So it's not just a credit card transaction or debit. It does both or all of these different accounts that you might have with the bank.
Behavioral finance is a huge topic now. I noticed you used the word nudge, which is something quite common in that vocabulary. What are some of the other concepts that you were designing in to help people?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, just before we go on to another one, because I think the finance save is an interesting thing about helping Canadians. But the 5 categories I just wanted to mention around entertainment, shopping, cash withdrawals, transportation, and dining. I think the thing that's important about Nomi budgeting is it's made it very, very simple around those categories. So I just thought I should close that off for your listeners as well, because if any of them had that experience with those other apps you talk about trying to aggregate, then it gets extremely complicated. Thanks for your question about other things. One which we're really bullish is we've got Anomi as a family of capabilities, and there's two other capabilities all within the mobile app which are worth mentioning. The first is it gives insights into spend and all sorts of transactional behavior for a customer. And the second is around find and save, both of which add significant value to our customer base. The nudges, we've just gone past 500 million nudges to customers. And that's everything from saying, hey, Peter, we've noticed you've had an unusual transaction and there's a merchant you've never used before. Maybe just check its use, so things like security, through to really giving a really detailed aggregation background about when I've traveled to the US and showing all my spend, and many, many different nudges. So this is a really big number. 500 million is a large amount of information going to Canadians, which wasn't provided before.
One last question before we go. How do you deal with the inherent conflicts of interest in a big bank such as RBC? And one example of that is if you had the P&L on the credit card business, you would be very interested in people transacting using their cards and also quite comfortable with them carrying an outstanding balance, right? Because that's not bad for your business. But if you were solely focused on Canadians improving their financial behavior, you'd say, listen, we know that people spend less if they use cash, and we don't want anybody to have an outstanding balance ever. How do you internally reconcile those things within such a large institution?
We have to always focus, and we have these very decent conversations around doing what's right for customers. And we do take it very, very seriously. So there are nudges in there that which allow for customers to be reminded that their credit card balance is due. The other thing which I just call up there too is that keeping things in cash is not necessarily the best thing for customers to do. So keeping cash holdings, you're not only exposed to theft or loss, but it's also about that means that that is out of an account and not necessarily earning interest either. So we are trying to assist Canadians through nudges for insights, Nomi Insights. Find and Save's fascinating because we're seeing about 20% of people with these new Find and Save accounts, these AI-driven savings accounts, have never had a savings product before. Mm. So there's a good example. That'd be 20, 30,000 Canadians who have never saved, starting to save for the first time, which is a really good social thing to do as well.
Interesting.
So there are some very good intents. All of these things we're rolling out, it's not about collecting fees or revenue. It is about helping Canadians with savings, having a better relationship with the bank, and making sure we're doing the right thing by our customers.
Interesting. Well, good luck with the launch, and we'll check in again to see how things are going.
Thanks, Bruce. Much appreciated.
Peter Tilton is Senior Vice President of Digital at RBC, and he was here to talk about the Nomi budget. One of the ways that I think we can improve how people behave when it comes to our money is to talk about it. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And so that's why we've launched this new segment called How I Do It, in which every show I talk to one of our guests about how they actually manage their personal finances. And some people do this for a living. Other people don't do this for a living. But I ask them kind of the same questions. None of these questions are ones that I would not answer myself on this show or in a public forum. Our guest today, David Bock, author of The Latte Factor. For How I Do It, David, just the first thing that pops to your mind, and this question is, you do buy coffee at a coffee shop, which I assume you do every once in a while when you can't make the espresso at home. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit? Or do you eschew coffee unless you can make it at home?
That's such a funny question. It's almost always credit. I rarely carry cash.
What do you use cash for? Anything? I use it for my kids' allowance. That's about it.
I like, it happens to be this very moment in time I've got money in my pocket. But
right.
I still rarely have cash. And you're right. It ends up getting handed out to my wife or my kids, the babysitter or the dog walker. I just don't carry a lot of cash. I don't know. In New York, you're constantly, you know, getting out of, you know, I don't know. I'm a credit card guy.
Yeah. What about your life? What about your life is not automated? And I know who I'm talking to. I know about the automatic millionaire, so I'm sure much of your life is. Is there anything that isn't by design?
Huh, that's a good question. You know, almost every bill that I have is automated, unless it can't be. All the income that I have coming in is automated in the fact that it gets automatically deposited, unless it can't be. Like, I just received a a royalty check on something. That's, you know, I would call it still old school, right? Like they actually sent me a check. And almost every time I try to get those checks removed, where I get the whoever's sending us money to deposit it automatically. You know, my money is rebalanced for the most part automatically. But what's not automated? I'm self-employed. So
yeah.
You know, I'm always talking about automated, you know, investments in the retirement accounts. But I'll give you a classic example. Like when I fund my, in the U.S., it's called a SEP IRA account. I'm waiting until the end of the year because I need to know what were my taxes and what percentage of my income can I be putting away. So I'm usually writing, I'm writing my SEP IRA contribution typically in a lump sum right at the beginning of the year when I know exactly what I look like tax-wise.
What are you nuts about when it comes to your money and what are you casual about? Even a personal finance expert like you should surely be able to force the spectrum here on nuts versus casual. Like, are you nuts about what you spend on groceries or what are you not nuts about?
Well, yes.
You're nuts about everything?
That's about, I'm like, I think what I'm a little bit nuts about right now is what's happening to the cost of taking a cab in New York City. So I've lived in New York City for 18 years and they just added a $3 tax on every single New York cab you get in. So but you get into a cab and the moment you get in the cab with the taxes and all the miscellaneous fees, you're like at $5 and you haven't even gone a block. So you know when I've been coming to, I'm 52, but I've been coming to New York since a kid, right? You still get from downtown to uptown for $7. So the cost of a cab is becoming prohibitive, and I take a lot more subways now because I hate wasting money and I don't like being ripped off. And so I think the opposite of that is, you know, what do I love? I love to find a good deal. So a great example is if I don't have to book a hotel in advance, like I'm going to go to L.A. next week, and I'm going to just gamble on Monday that I'm going to land in LAX on Memorial Day. I'm going to click on an app like, you know, hotels tonight. And I'm going to just try to find the best deal I can in a hotel, and I'm going to hopefully save 50% on a hotel because I'm going to get the hotel the day of. So I like finding deals when it's possible to do without massively inconveniencing my life.
Who manages your investments? Are you a DIY guy, robo, or full-service financial advisor?
Well, I mean, look, I'm a co-founder of a registered investment advisory firm. So AE Wealth Management today has over $7 billion on its platform. I sit on the investment committee, and so I would tell you that the firm that I own a piece of is managing certainly a portion of my money because it's in our modeled portfolios. So, you know, I sit on the investment committee, but we have institutional money managers overseeing those portfolios. I have an investment committee call tomorrow. So part of my money is in the models that our firm manages, and part of the money is in portfolios that I had already created before I became a co-founder of this company. And I oversee those.
Do you have an actual financial plan, like the document, the really, really financial plan versus the one that some people kind of are like, I don't know, like it tells me how much I need to retire?
Yeah, I have a real financial plan. And it's kind of the thing I go back and, you know, my wife and I sit down at the end of the year. We look at where our numbers are. And we kind of like we have goals, like we create financial goals. Even though it's like we're getting ready to go off to Florence, Italy. I'm like, okay, honey, this is kind of where we are financially. This is what the goal is going to be around our spending, and we're on top of it.
I believe you're on top of it. Yeah,
on top of it.
It would be off-brand if you were not on top of it. What would you say has been your best financial move in life?
You know, it's a bit, I've talked about this publicly, so this is like old news, but I'm just a huge, one of the things we even discuss is, but in the book, a big lesson Zoe learns is also she has to go from being a renter to being an owner. And she had, you know, the way you get rich is you have to own your home. And I have lived in San Francisco and New York, and the best investments have been simply buying a home and living in it. And we just sold our apartment in New York because we're getting ready to move to Florence, and it was just a remarkable investment. Everything I've ever bought from a home standpoint has just simply turned out fantastic.
And you chose your cities well. It wasn't, you know, I don't know, Detroit in the 80s or Phoenix in 2008.
No, that's right. And, you know, there is an element, and people always say real estate's location, location, location. There's an element to that. It's also financing, but it's time. And then there's timing. But, you know, I've lived in New York 18 years, and the cost of rent has tripled. And guess what? The cost of a home has tripled, right? So rent, you know, this idea that renting is less expensive than owning is just not true. And I toured Canada for years with Scotiabank, and I remember going across Canada with The Automatic Millionaire, talking about the latte factor, with the book Start Late, Finish Rich, and saying across Canada, you guys don't even realize what a good deal your real estate is. Like, Toronto real estate has more than doubled since we were talking about
it. It has played out that way.
And it's just, you know, when you have these great cities, like a city like Toronto where you are, these are cities that people want to live in and cities that people move money to. So it's, you know, if you're going to be somewhere for 10 years, you should own. You shouldn't rent.
David, I really appreciate your time and have an amazing summer in Florence. It's going to be hot.
Yeah, well, we're going to be going to the islands, too. So we're going to be in the Amalfi Coast and Sicily. And, yeah, I'll be thinking about you when we eat a little pasta and pizza.
The whole thing.
Thanks for having me on your show. I love your country, and I just appreciate all our Canadian readers. Super grateful to everybody up there. And I know your show goes all over the world, but thanks a lot for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. David Bach, author of The Latte Factor. That's our show for today. Subscribe to it on your podcast platform. And hey, feel free to write a review for all you social butterflies out there. Connect with me on social media. Facebook is Bruce Selry Moolala or @BruceSelry on Twitter. Thanks very much for joining us and have a great day.